It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, a new report shows there are fewer political ads on TV in this election than there were in 2010. We'll talk to a political scientist about what this means for the election.
First, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates running for Attorney General of Wisconsin. It's the first open race for the position since 2002, as current Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen announced he wouldn't be seeking another term.
There are three candidates seeking the office. We've already heard from two of them, Republican Brad Schimmel and Libertarian Tom Nelson. Now we turn to the Democrat in the race.
Susan Happ is the district attorney of Jefferson County, and she's the Democratic candidate for Attorney General of Wisconsin. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've had you on once before, back in the primary race. Right off the bat, I'll ask you the same question I started with then. Why are you running for Attorney General of Wisconsin?
Well, and my answer hasn't changed. You know, I ran for Attorney General because I decided that Wisconsin citizens deserved better. And part of that is, you know, the need to take politics out of that office and start working on bringing our citizens back together again. We obviously want to work together to make our communities safer, to make our citizens stronger, and I believe I'm the best candidate to do that. And part of that's, you know, based on where I come from, being a Democrat in a Republican county and being able to point to my record and show that, you know, I have a willingness and a history of working together with people on both sides of the aisle.
The two other candidates, we have Republican Brad Schimmel and Libertarian Tom Nelson. Other than the party label, what sets you apart from your opponents?
Well, certainly, you know, my background. I mean, you know, we came through a tough three-way primary, as you know, and, you know, unlike my Republican opponent, you know, I wasn't handpicked by my political party. You know, I won the nomination in a tough three-way primary, and the people chose me. And so, as I've been saying from the very beginning, you know, this is about bringing our citizens back together, and it's about you know, being able to earn votes not just from my Democratic base, but independents and Republicans, you know, earning their trust and keeping that trust.
The latest Marquette University Law School poll suggests that this is a really close race. It's neck and neck, but a good majority of Wisconsin voters are still unfamiliar with you and your opponents, don't know enough about you maybe to form an opinion. What are you doing to reach out and introduce yourself and make a name among the voters?
Well, we're doing a lot of the same work that we did in the primary, which is, you know, traveling to as many places as we can and talking to folks, you know, about the issues and asking them about what issues are of concern to them. And so we're going to do the hard work, and we're going to continue talking to people, you know, about protecting their rights and about, you know, keeping our community safe, protecting consumers. All of the things that led to our success in the primary are going to be part of our success in the general election. So we're just going to keep reaching out to as many folks as we have been in the primary, just like we did then. We're going to keep doing that in the general. And we ran a, you know, great, strong campaign in the primary, and we're going to keep doing that for the next 35 days.
So a big issue that's been coming out in the news lately, you've taken some heat over the last few weeks over some cases you were involved in the past, mostly relating to plea deals. Republicans or Republican-affiliated outside groups accusing you of going easy on an alleged child molester with a deferred prosecution agreement, somebody you'd had a real estate transaction with, a plea deal for a sex offender they're pointing to in 2009. How do you respond to what they're saying?
Sure. So, you know, that's not what this case really, this campaign is going to be about. What we want to know and what we want to stress to people is that, you know, I'm going to be an advocate for our citizens. I'm going to truly represent all of our citizens. And, you know, here's the problem. You know, DA Schimmel and I have both been attorneys for, I've been attorney for 16 years now. Schimmel's been an attorney for the same amount of time. And we all have cases where if there are people on the opposite side, you want to point to a particular case and try to take it out of context. You know, that's a road that I don't want to go down because, number one, it's not fair, and number two, I think it does a disservice to the voters because we know that in cases that we handle that there are plea negotiations made in virtually every case, and ultimately a recommendation is made to a court, and a court has to ultimately sentence an offender to what sentence they believe is appropriate. So there's an appropriate system of checks and balances in place. As far as is the case, you know, with the land contract with my husband, that was a case where I appropriately screened myself off of the file as the ethical rules require, had no involvement in either the charging decision or its resolution. And that's what our rules require. And DA Schimmel has had a similar case that's being currently prosecuted by his office. I don't think there's anything improper in that case either. So, you know, we want to focus on the issues that matter to voters. We want to, you know, focus on reaching, you know, as many voters as possible to talk about the issues that matter. And that's primarily protecting, you know, protecting our citizens, keeping our communities safe, making sure that, yes, the next attorney general is that top cop, but there's a whole lot of things that the attorney general's office does that aren't criminal in nature. You know, they're civil in nature, and I've got a broader background than my opponent in that regard because I spent a decade in private practice handling civil matters and juvenile matters, as well as criminal matters. So I believe I've got, you know, broader experience in that regard, and that's what we want this race to be about, not about mudslinging. And I don't think the voters are going to be interested in that.
But both you and Brad Schimmel point toward your experience as prosecutors as a big part of your resume here. Isn't it fair to take the data we gain from looking at both of your records?
Absolutely, as long as we look at our records in a fair light. And I think that's the problem with taking, you know, one case or a second case and viewing them, you know, as snippets without looking at the full picture. And so I think it does a disservice to the voters if you take a case and simply, you know, summarize the case and say, well, here's what happened in that case without knowing all of the facts. So certainly our records are fair to look at. I mean, look, we've both been frontline prosecutors. We've prosecuted, you know, homicide cases and sexual assaults and internet predators, heroin dealers, and some really violent people. And, you know, I spent the last 6 years of my life dedicated to making Jefferson County a safer place to live. And, you know, I'm proud of my record in that regard.
So as Attorney General, if elected, you'd be working closely with the governor. It could be Scott Walker, could be Mary Burke. It's a very close race there. How do you see the relationship between the governor and the Attorney General? And could you work with someone from the opposite party?
I absolutely could work effectively with any governor, regardless of his or her party. I have a proven record of working across party lines, you know, to get the job done. You know, as I said in the beginning, I'm the only elected Democratic official in my courthouse, but I've been able to work with the Republican officials, you know, in my county because public safety is not a partisan issue. And so, you know, I've worked with my Republican sheriff and others in my courthouse to help save taxpayers over $250,000. And so I've never been afraid to work with people on the other side of the aisle. In fact, you know, I have a great record of doing just that. In terms of the relationship with the governor, I mean, I do have a little different view than that. I know that my opponent has said that he would be a good complement to the governor. And while you certainly work with the governor, the attorney general's office is a distinct branch of government, and it can and should serve as an appropriate check and balance on the governor. So and regardless of who becomes governor, I'm confident I can have a great working relationship with our next governor.
Let's get into some of the issues the next attorney general would face. The state's voter ID law has changed some since the last time we've talked to you. It's now in place for the election you're participating in. There is talk potentially of more challenge, maybe taking to the Supreme Court. Do you, as attorney general, defend the state's voter ID law in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, you know, the attorney general does have the duty to defend state laws, but, you know, like my district attorney oath, I also take an oath to uphold the Constitution. So if the legislature passes a law that I firmly believe to be unconstitutional, you know, I cannot ethically defend it. So, you know, this case is still evolving in terms of our current voter ID law. I have concerns, as I've said previously, that it is unconstitutional because we have three very clear constitutional requirements that voters in Wisconsin must have to be eligible to vote, and our current voter ID law adds a fourth. It adds the governmental issue photo ID. And the concern I've got with the law right now, with the injunction being lifted so close to the general election now, is that we've only got a little bit over a month here for upwards of 300,000 folks to try to get that governmental issued ID. And as we look at the cases that's progressed through our courts now in Wisconsin, we have one federal court who agreed with my concerns about its constitutionality, and now we have another that's disagreed. So obviously, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court may decide this issue, and certainly Wisconsin and I would be bound by that decision, whatever it may be.
A related issue, another Wisconsin law, a constitutional amendment, actually, that could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, the same-sex marriage ban. Would you defend that before the Supreme Court?
That one, you know, that one I have a bigger issue with, because it is, it has been found to be unconstitutional, not just by, you know, the court in Wisconsin, but by other courts. In that case, it's true that the voters did pass the constitutional amendment to define marriage as between a man and a woman. The problem with that is we still have to comport with the United States Constitution. And one court after another has struck down these types of laws. And so that our ban against same-sex marriage, I believe, to be violative of the Equal Protection Clause, and that is a law that I would not defend. And look, I want to be clear. When we talk about the Attorney General's obligation to defend laws, that is absolutely true. But as I said, if there is a law that is in direct conflict with the Wisconsin or the United States Constitution, then you have to take a harder look at that. And there have been previous attorneys general who have not defended other laws, including the current attorney general, who said he would not defend the domestic partnership registry. And in fact, Attorney Schimmel has also said that he would not have defended the domestic partnership registry. So it's rare, and it's the exception, but that does happen where past attorneys general have declined to defend laws that they knew to be unconstitutional.
We're talking with Susan Happ, Democratic candidate for attorney general, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
Do you have a question for Susan Happ, or are you wondering where she stands on an issue? You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up with Susan Happ in just a moment, but first, here's a look at headlines with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Democratic Attorney General candidate Susan Happ. She's one of three candidates running for that office. If you've got a question for her or wondering where she stands on a particular issue, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our callers now. We've got Larry on the line in New Berlin. Larry, hi.
Yes, I've been a lifetime Democrat, and we moved here about 4 years ago, and I noticed that it seems to be more in the drink. And anyway, I read a little bit of a description before the primary of her stand on drunk driving. It sounds like she would not want to make it a felony, and I'd like to have her explain that. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Larry, thanks for the call. And Susan, I think you were talking about first-time offenses.
Correct. And so it came up a lot in the primary whether Wisconsin should criminalize first offense drunk driving. And I think what Larry just talked about was making it a felony. And I certainly wouldn't support making first offense drunk driving a felony. Currently under Wisconsin law, if you get to a fourth offense and the previous offenses within 5 years, it becomes a felony. So you'd be making probably three or four different other OWI-type offenses felonies. But the basic answer that I have with regard to criminalizing it in the first place is that we know that drunk driving is both a law enforcement and a cultural issue here in Wisconsin. And so in determining penalties for drunk driving, we have to focus on what strategies work best to reduce incidents of drunk driving. And we don't have evidence to show that criminalizing, in other words, making someone a convicted criminal and potentially putting them in jail for some short period of time, actually is going to deter a driver from getting behind the wheel. There's no question that first offense drunk driving is a danger, not just to the driver, but to innocent people on the roadways. But the person gets behind the wheel knowing that they could kill him or herself. They could kill a passenger or an innocent motorist, and they could either die or spend decades in prison, and they get behind the wheel nonetheless. So until we had that kind of evidence in terms of deterrence, I wouldn't support the criminalization of the first offense, drunk driving. If people learn, you know, from their contact with the justice system, I think that's a plus. What I do know is that we absolutely have to look at increasing the minimum penalties for our repeat drunk drivers. And we need to do a better job of educating our kids about the dangers of drinking and driving. And so I have talked very candidly about the fact that we should be looking at increasing those minimums. If you have a fourth-time drunk driver in Wisconsin, they can serve as little as 60 days in jail, and we know that that's woefully inadequate. So there's no question, Larry, that we definitely have to do more to address both the cultural issue and the obvious law enforcement and public protection issues of drunk driving in Wisconsin.
One issue, a priority you've highlighted in your campaign is protecting children online and putting a stop to online predators. What would your plan involve?
Right. So we know that predators are prowling the internet, and we also know that the Department of Justice is uniquely situated to investigate these offenders, to get those cases over to local law enforcement and to district attorneys so that these offenders can be prosecuted quickly. So what we want to do, you know, when we talk about internet crimes against children, is have an efficient way of addressing those types of referrals that are coming in, you know, faster now than ever. As our technology has improved, so have the offenders. And so we know that we've got to have an ability to quickly process those internet crimes against children, and we've got to have protocols that focus on results and don't worry about credit, who's getting the credit for the arrests or the charges. And I believe we need a dedicated point person in the Department of Justice to work directly with agents at the Division of Criminal Investigation to make sure that these tips are timely, processed, and handed off to local law enforcement. And I'll tell you, coming from Jefferson County, another thing that we've seen here is that the Department of Justice does a great job of training law enforcement on how to investigate these crimes. The harder part of it is in my county, we had a single officer in a county of about 85,000 people who was actually putting that training to great use. He was able to actually have offenders come to our state, to our county, intending to have sex with a 14-year-old girl, only to find a law enforcement officer. And those offenders were arrested, prosecuted, and many of them sent to prison. Unfortunately, the drain on resources from a law enforcement perspective, the time that goes into those types of investigations, is a lot. It takes its toll on these departments. And so now in my county, I have no one in my county who can actually participate in these investigations so that I can actually have these offenders arrested and prosecuted. So that is something that I think we need to look at, alternative ways so that we can provide necessary support to local law enforcement so they can continue the good work and actually implement the training that they've received.
I wanted to ask you about open government and government transparency. There have been some calls to the next attorney general to make that a priority. How would you, or would you make a commitment to open government? How would you put that into practice?
Well, absolutely. To answer your second question first, absolutely I would make that a priority. I mean, Wisconsin has a strong tradition of open government. We have some of the best laws on the books. And the reality is that I think we need to work diligently to restore the trust and the faith and the confidence that our citizens have in their elected officials. So I would take allegations of open meetings and open violations very seriously, and that would apply across the board. This is not a partisan issue. So I would aggressively prosecute anyone who betrays or violates the public trust, regardless of their political affiliation.
One of the biggest law enforcement issues that we hear about in Wisconsin lately, and this has gone to the legislature too, is heroin. What, as Attorney General, would you do to enforce the state's laws and to try to cut back on the heroin epidemic in the state?
Yeah, heroin has a death grip on every county in our state, and it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care if you are African-American or white, male, female, young, old. And so we need a multifaceted, collaborative approach to the heroin epidemic that we're seeing. And that's not an overstatement, by the way. It is an epidemic. And so we have to combine law enforcement efforts with education, prevention, and treatment. And so, you know, as a district attorney in Jefferson County, I have aggressively prosecuted the heroin dealers because they put the lives of others at risk. I've also been a founding member of my Jefferson County Heroin Task Force. I work with law enforcement, county officials, educators, and community leaders to help inform citizens and our youngsters about the dangers and availability of opiates. And so when we talk about this, it's not just heroin, it's pills as well. And, you know, education is very important. And I would take what we've been doing here in Jefferson County in terms of informing our citizens and our community leaders, and I would take that initiative statewide to make sure that every county is able to bring that information to its citizens, because it's so moving when people hear the story, for example, in my county, of a mother who lost her 17-year-old daughter to a heroin overdose. And so I think we need to bring a face, you know, to what heroin looks like, what a heroin addict looks like, because it is not the stereotypical, you know, middle-aged or older-aged white man, you know, who's transient or you know, living on the streets. It doesn't discriminate, as I said, and I think if we can help humanize the face of heroin addiction and aggressively address, you know, go after the dealers, but also work closely to rehabilitate those who are addicted in the community, we can start having a significant impact on this epidemic in our state.
Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Susan Happ. She's the district attorney of Jefferson County. She's the Democratic candidate for Attorney General of Wisconsin. We'll have interviews with all three of those candidates up at the WPR.org website. Also, remember to check out WisconsinVote.org for election information.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, everyone from the New York Times to Vogue is talking about how big butts are a trend. But can body parts really be a trend? And are large behinds anything new?
Well, first we're taking a look at a new report on campaign ad spending in Wisconsin.
It's a big election year, but the Nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity just released a report showing TV campaign ad spending is down significantly from the last race for governor in Wisconsin.
Here to talk about this new report and what it could mean for our governor's race is Barry Burton. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly does report tell us about campaign ad spending in Wisconsin during this election cycle?
Well, the report says that compared to 4 years ago during the 2010 campaign, the number of ads is down pretty sharply and the amount of spending is down pretty sharply. Both of those are about half of where they were at this time in 2010.
That seems surprising. So how much lower is TV ad spending than it was in 2010?
Well, it looks like through the first week of September, about $5.5 million has been spent on television ads, and that compares to about $11.5 million that was spent back in 2010. So it's a pretty noticeable drop.
So what are the theories about why this is happening, that the TV ads are not spending as much this season?
Well, I think it's a really complicated story, so there's not a single explanation. There are a number of races around the country where ad money is also down, and so it's not entirely a Wisconsin story. Some of it has to do with the fact that in 2010 there was also a U.S. Senate race on the ballot, and that had a pretty hotly contested primary in which there was a governor's race for the primary and also a Senate race for the primary, and those drew money in a way that this governor's race has not so far. There was not a hot primary this time around and not a Senate race at all. So part of it is just a difference in what was on the ballot and how many candidates were running.
Does this represent, do you think, larger trends about, you know,
yeah,
maybe candidates funneling their money toward, you know, things other than TV ads?
Yeah, I think there are a few things happening. One may be that candidates are putting their money elsewhere. It may be in field operations, trying to get volunteers and paid campaign workers to go door to door. Research has shown that that's a much more effective way to persuade people to come to your side and to mobilize people who are already your supporters. It might also be that money is being spent on online activities or other things that aren't captured by TV advertising itself.
Any idea how the ad money for TV ads compares to spending during the 2012 recall elections? Those are more recent in terms of statewide elections.
Well, I'm not sure that we'll ever reach the records that were set in the 2012 recall. There was something like $80 million spent in that governor's race. That was more than double what was spent in the 2010 governor's race. Right now, it's difficult to see us even getting to the level of the 2010 race. And I should just point out, there was about $37 million spent in that 2010 race. At this time, 4 years ago, only $11 million had been spent. So there was another $20 or $25 million pumped into the campaign just in the last 45 to 60 days. So we should expect a real ramping up here over this last month of the campaign.
Do we have any idea whether this echoes national trends, that maybe candidates are spending their money elsewhere nationally?
It does seem to be happening elsewhere as well. It's not just a Wisconsin story. There are certainly races that are getting a lot of spending. There were a few governor's races in states like Pennsylvania and Florida, where there are just millions of dollars being spent by the campaigns. And there's some really hotly contested Senate races in places like Kentucky, where there's an awful lot of spending going on. So it's possible that there are some donors who have been putting their money strategically into these states where the races are really hard fought. And at least for a while, it looked like Wisconsin was not going to be competitive. Walker was ahead in the polls until about July. And I think at that point, people began to believe that this race was tightening up and was going to be a close one. And I think that has started to bring some money back into Wisconsin from some other states.
We had a comment on Facebook from Jen who said, I think Walker spent his money spamming YouTube with ads. Every single video has ads. Has there been, do you think, evidence that internet spending is a huge part of where candidates are leaning?
I don't know if I would say huge just yet, but there has been a shift in campaign spending toward online media rather than traditional television. Traditional TV is still the dominant way that candidates reach out to voters. But, you know, Wisconsin is in a different place than it was 5 or 10 years ago in terms of the number of people who are already committed to one side or the other. Very few undecided voters. So spending money on media to try to persuade people is probably going to be less effective. And really running ads or emails or the sponsored YouTube clips, whatever it would be, to your supporters, where you really just need to get them out, not convince them that your side is right. That is increasingly looking like a smart strategy.
And what about voter fatigue? You know, here in Wisconsin, we've been through a lot. You know, 2012 isn't that long ago when we had, you know, our last big ad campaigns. Is there evidence that maybe there's just, you know, fatigue from voters and candidates? Maybe they just want to soft pedal it this election?
I don't think the campaigns have any courtesy when it comes to being nice to voters. They're really just trying to figure out how to spend dollars wisely and how to raise as much as they'll need, maybe more than they'll need. Why the spending is a little light this year is just a little bit of a mystery. I've offered a few explanations, but I think we still don't quite have a handle on why there have just been fewer ads this time around. Voters should be thankful for the time being, but be warned, it's going to be coming back here shortly.
Well, we've also got people unplugging from cable in greater numbers, watching their content on Netflix, Hulu, other sources, so they're not, you know, maybe receiving ads in traditional ways. I suppose that could be something that we should be thinking about, too.
It is easier today to avoid political news and avoid the ads that are often associated with it. It turns out that the people who do that, who are unplugging or watching media in non-traditional ways, are also less likely to be active voters. If you look at where TV advertising is placed, it's often around local news. It's around game shows like Wheel of Fortune. It's aimed at demographics where there are regular voters who are going to be affected by those ads. So certainly the campaigns are aware of this, and it just becomes more difficult for them to try to reach people who are outside the traditional ways of viewing media.
So you've said that we can expect to see the ads coming back as we get closer and closer to Election Day. Do you think we're going to reach levels of 2010 spending?
It's possible. We're behind the trend to reach that level, but it could happen. What was different in 2010 is there were more outside groups involved in the spending. That was also true in the recall year in the summer of 2012. This year so far, there's really been very little spending by outside groups. Most of the $5.5 million that's been spent in the governor's race has been the campaigns of Scott Walker and Mary Burke. Very little from groups like Emily's List and the Republican Governors Association. The NRA has recently come into the state running ads. But I think those groups are likely to step up their bids and put more money into the state, as this looks like really a national race to watch.
Well, Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It was good speaking with you.
We've been speaking with Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about a new report showing a drop in spending on TV campaign ads.
Big, big booty, what you got, a big booty.
Oh.
Big, big booty, what you got, a big booty.
Big,
big.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Can a body part be a trend? Hemlines rise and fall, jeans flare out and taper in, but how about actual parts of your body?
If you read some of the country's biggest mainstream trend commentators, it appears that big butts have actually become a trend. Everyone from the New York Times to Vanity Fair to Vogue has done a feature on big booties, with Vogue saying, we're officially in the era of the big booty.
songs and music videos by some of the most popular artists out there have also added to the conversation. Names like Beyonce, Nicki Minaj, and Jennifer Lopez have lately all featured music and moves that emphasize the butt, like the song we just heard by J-Lo called Booty.
But should we see bodies in this light? And is the conversation ignoring what some commentators are pointing out, that big behinds have been celebrated in Latino and African-American communities for a long time? Kara Brown joins us now. She's a staff writer at Jezebel. Kara, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So according to Vogue, big butts are officially in style. And it's kind of interesting to say about a body part that everybody has. What do you think? Can big booties be a fashion trend?
You know, I think it's difficult to describe a body part as a trend. You know, I think you can say that perhaps this new focus in the mainstream pop culture sphere, which is sort of understood to largely be a white audience, it might be a trend in that way. But something that that's a part of your body and isn't going anywhere when the trend does or does not die, you know, it's hard for me to use that word in this instance.
Well, let's lay out the evidence, at least as Vogue sees it. What is the evidence that we're in a new era where big butts are what everybody wants?
They're basically arguing that there are a lot of female artists right now who are drawing attention to to their butts, that having a big butt now is something that a lot more women are looking to achieve. They point to Jen Seltzer, who is a Instagram star. She's sort of a fitness model, and she has a very round, prominent booty. And they're basically saying that now this is something that women want, which, you know, perhaps there are certain women who now want it. But like you said earlier, Latino and African American cultures, this is a body part that we've celebrated, and you know, having a big butt was always something that was considered beautiful and was something that was envied.
And by the way, as a side note to that, apparently everyone now needs to know the word Belfie, short for butt selfie.
Oh gosh, yeah.
I haven't taken one yet. I hope never to take one, but I guess they're out there.
You and me both.
Well, what do you make of the fact that, you know, you've got Vogue, usually features waif-like women models like Kate Moss in their magazine, that they're trying to jump on top of this big booty trend? Is this a fact trying to get out ahead of a story that's already broken, in effect?
I mean, I guess, you know, that's definitely one way to look at it. I think that they have, I think what really happened is they have the Kim Kardashians and the Jen Seltzers, and I think that they've found women that they are more comfortable putting in their magazines who have this figure, who have this shape, and to them, that makes it a thing now, because they could have had, just so many women of color, actresses, singers, just all types of women who had this figure and celebrated this figure for so long. But basically now that white girls have kind of discovered it or decided that having a big butt is actually kind of cool, now they have women that I think that they prefer to put in their magazine.
And we're going to listen to a track that goes back a ways, maybe credited with launching a long time ago some of the new feelings about butts. This is Jennifer Lopez.
I like big butts, and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny that when a girl walks in with an itty bitty.
Oh, it's a different one. It's called Got Back, another butt classic.
Baby Got Back,
and by the way, there's quite a genre around butt songs. There's also the bass song, which is out right now. This one's by Sir Mix-a-Lot. And, you know, you were talking about race before, and the Vogue piece about big butts was pretty dainty about race. They didn't use the word black or African American. And they were talking about, Nicki Minaj, Rihanna. But do you see this because of this you're describing? Is it essentially a case of cultural appropriation?
I think in some way it can be. I think the main issue for me is that, if you want to talk about big butts, and if Vogue wants to say that, hey, we weren't really down with them before, but now we've decided this is something we like, then cool, that's fine. But what I have a problem with is erasing women of color from that narrative. So yes, they do mention Rihanna, and they do mention Nicki Minaj and Beyonce, and we all know that they're black women, but that completely misses the fact that in a lot of, in these cultures, this was a desirable trait for a very long time. So it's not just that, oh, look, we have Beyonce now and she has a big butt, but she was proud of her figure and she has been, and, you know, you can go back to old interviews of Beyonce talking about being curvy and loving her body because she grew up in a culture where that was something to be admired. So the fact that, you know, they don't mention women of color specifically is what I have an issue with, because it's just erasing us from discussions about beauty and erasing us as examples of beautiful women, really.
Well, when a trend or an idea goes mainstream or gets co-opted, depending on your point of view, what happens to the community that, you know, sort of birthed the idea?
I think now you have a lot of people in these communities that are looking at this kind of with a little bit of side eye, like, okay, cool, they just figured it out. And the thing is, now it's profitable, right? So Jen Felter is making a lot of money off her body when there are so many other black and brown women who were fitness instructors and did a lot of squats and had the exact same sort of brand that Jen Felter is peddling, but they weren't being paid attention to. And I think you see now, you know, Nicki Minaj coming out with a song called Anaconda and Jennifer Lopez with Booty. You know, this is not like them just looking down and realizing, oh, hey, I have a big butt, this is something cool. They just realize that it's become profitable for them to sing about it and really call attention to it.
You know, you talked about there being sort of a white ideal earlier, and I think a lot of women have felt like they needed to fit into that ideal that you see in fashion magazines. Women have been straightening their hair for a long time and dieting. You know, does this change the way that, you know, women of color get talked about in the conversation about beauty?
You know, I would hope that, if anything, it widens the picture of what we see as beautiful. You know, this isn't to say that having a big butt makes you more beautiful than not, or that being really thin is less beautiful than being curvy. You know, this is about women having different body types, because that's just how, you know, we do, and women look different, and sort of understanding that beauty can look a lot of different ways. And I think that's what I would hope would be the takeaway from conversations like this. Not that, oh, I hope now everyone, you know, is out doing squats and wants a big butt, but that they're saying, okay, this is beautiful, and so is this, and so is this. And I think necessarily widening that view, you end up seeing more women of color.
And do you think it's going to do that? Are we going to be more accepting? Or is this, you know, just a blip on the radar for Vogue, just a trend that they're pointing to and wanting to be part of, and then, you know, next season, mm-hmm. butts are out again?
You know, for something like Vogue and the New York Times, Vogue is trends, and reporting on trends is pretty much their entire approach. That's what they do. So I think it would be naive for me to think that now Vogue is going to start hiring models with curvier figures and things like that. I think that they are kind of jumping on something that is popular right now and that very popular artists are talking about. So I would hope that maybe it could, you know, maybe Vogue will start featuring curvier models and things like that, and designers will start designing for wider hips and a bigger butt. But I don't, unfortunately, have a ton of faith in that. But, you know, you never know.
Are there things that you think women of color would like to see when it comes to being included in the cultural conversation about what beauty is?
Yeah, I mean, I think we would like to be included. For example, the LA Times wrote an article about cornrows about a week ago, and they didn't mention any black women. And again, it's just, you can't erase us from this. I think we just want to be included, and I think that we want credit for the same things that, for doing the things that white women will do also. You know, if it's beautiful on them, it's beautiful on us as well.
Now, you wrote this piece in Jezebel about butts, saying, hey, you know, butts have been around for a long time. You know, get with it, Vogue. What kind of response did it get?
I mostly get, I get really great responses from a lot of women of color who are noticing the same thing. You know, there are a lot of people who will say, you know, you don't get to own a body type. You can't say that having a big butt is only a black thing. And I've never said that. What I've said is that it's something that was celebrated in these cultures, and I really don't think it has been celebrated in this larger mainstream culture the way it has been for other communities. So a lot of people don't like when I say that, but I'm not in any way attributing this one quality to only black people or to all black women.
Anything you want to say there to encourage people to accept their booties, no matter what size, is no matter what Vogue says as we go forward?
Yeah, well, Vogue should not be your standard of what is and isn't beautiful, I would say. That comes from you.
All right, Kara, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Kara Brown, staff writer at Jezebel, talking about the cultural conversation going on right now about being in the so-called era of the big booty.